more liberal than the Latino U.S. senator that exists. You have two Cubans in Cruz and Rubio, who are also a Republican. But you have now four Democrats, Melendez and in Nevada, and a new one in Lujan in New Mexico. He will, I think, be more progressive than any of those.
Well, I want to thank you, Fernando Guerra. We'll be getting back in touch with you, professor of political science at Loyola Marymount University, director of the Center for the Study of Los Angeles. That does it for our show. On Tuesday, tune into our documentary, 4 Days in Western Sahara. On Friday, our interview with the late John Le Carré. Remember, wearing a mask is an act of love. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Coffee lovers, today is Nossa Familia Coffee Day on GiveGuide. When you donate $10 or more to KBOO on GiveGuide, you'll get a chance to win a 6-month coffee subscription to Nossa Familia. Go to kboo.fm/give to donate and for complete details.
So let's have another cup of coffee.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a week-long power outage at an Oregon prison has no end in sight. President Trump has threatened to veto the pandemic relief package, calling for $2,000 checks instead. And in international news, a new strain of COVID-19 in South Africa appears to be even more contagious than the one we've seen so far. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, December 23rd, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. The Oregon Health Authority reported 1,282 new cases of COVID-19 on Wednesday, bringing the total number of cases in the state up to 105,073. Oregon health officials also reported 35 new deaths, raising the state's death toll to 1,382 people. Multnomah County had the highest amount of cases, followed closely by Clackamas and Marion counties. Officials report that a person in southern Oregon knowingly went to work while sick, causing a super spreader action. Two separate outbreaks have now been traced back to that person, and 7 people died as a result. Oregon health centers began administering the first COVID-19 vaccines, and as of Wednesday, over 7,000 doses of the vaccine have been successfully administered in the state. Nearly all of the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines are going to healthcare workers and residents of long-term care facilities. The next round of vaccines will likely go to people over the age of 75, as well as some frontline essential workers. A spokesperson for the Oregon Health Authority said today, quote, "If we could vaccinate the 12% of Oregonians who are 70-plus years of age, we could prevent 76% of COVID-19 deaths. People 65 to 74, as well as those at high risk of contracting the virus, are expected to receive vaccines in the following wave of vaccinations." On top of a high COVID-19 infection rate, one of Oregon's largest prisons has been dealing with a major power outage for the last week. The power outage impacts at least 600 prisoners at the Two Rivers Correctional Institution in Umatilla County. According to prison officials, the outage is the result of two wires shorting and exploding underground after 20 years of degradation. Since the power loss on December 16th, the prison has used backup generators to provide heat and light. At least 85 prisoners are being treated for COVID-19 at the facility, which was likely brought into the facility by prison employees. Though there is no timeline yet for when power will be restored, staff are working to determine the cause of the outage. The holidays are a hard time for many folks, especially this year. Here's Eric Tegedoff with some tips to brighten up the holidays for family living in long-term care facilities.
The holidays are hard for many folks this year because of the pandemic, especially for people in long-term care facilities. AARP Oregon has suggestions for how families can make the season special for relatives who are residents of these homes. Joyce DeMonin with AARP Oregon says the first tip is to ask the person what they would like to do to celebrate the holidays.
A special meal or a holiday craft they would love to do, or just spending time on the phone or with a video conference call.
DeMonin says it's important to make celebrations intergenerational. Because COVID-19 cases are rising, in-person visits are still limited or suspended at most facilities in Oregon. And the caution is warranted. Although long-term care residents make up a small portion of the population, they account for nearly half of the state's COVID-19 deaths. DeMonin says families could do arts and crafts together via video calls. She also suggests picking out a Christmas movie or TV classic to watch, together or separately, and then talk about.
A lot of those movies and TV programs are very special, and we have a lot of memories of watching those with our family, and they can really help brighten up the week, too.
DeMonin says it's also important simply to reflect on the past with family.
It's really fun to kind of talk over some of our favorite holidays in the past and the family traditions that really make us feel like we're connected during the holidays.
Make sure to check with the facility in case a time has to be reserved for things like video visits, as some have limited tech capability or staff members to help if needed. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Eviction moratoriums have been a key step in keeping people housed during the coronavirus pandemic. As we reach the end of 2020, however, some are set to expire and others have been changed since they were first passed. For more, we go to KBOO's Sam Bowman to break down the state of evictions.
Recent days have seen several measures move forward at the federal, state, and local levels to address the looming housing crisis related to the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. This time last week, Portland renters were looking at a moratorium on evictions that ended on January 8, 2021. Even then, those renters would have been on the hook for all of their unpaid rent by the end of March. While some funding was made available through the Federal CARES Act to cover current and back rent for struggling tenants, most of these funds weren't available for Portland residents until October and cannot be spent past December 30th. According to the Local Information and Services Hotline 211, as of December 22nd, this funding is no longer being provided by any local agencies, and the county's rent assistance wait list is closed. Last Thursday, December 17th, Multnomah County extended its own eviction moratorium. The county moratorium is still the most generous policy covering Portlanders. It was extended until July 2nd, 2021, and retains the six-month grace period for renters to pay back their accumulated rent debt, which now begins on July 2nd. I will spare you the math. That gives Multnomah County residents until January 2nd, 2022 to repay their back rent. Now, if you are asking yourself, hey, I live in one of the tiny slivers of Portland that is not actually located within Multnomah County. What about me? Well, you're in luck because the city passed an ordinance months ago that pretty much piggybacks on whatever Multnomah County is doing, so that means that all Portlanders are covered by the county's policy. The extension of Multnomah County's moratorium happened a day before the state legislature began meeting for its third emergency session of the year. On Monday evening, the legislature voted to approve an extension of the statewide eviction moratorium until July 1, 2021, but the policy itself has changed significantly, and these changes still affect Multnomah County residents indirectly. That's because the new state policy ropes in landlords, who can now apply for funding to cover unpaid rent if their tenants sign a legal form declaring that they have been unable to pay rent at any point after March 16, 2020, due to COVID-related reasons. This is complicated, mostly due to the different emergency measures put in place at different times as the pandemic has continued to disrupt the economy. For unpaid rent during the time period of April to September 2020, renters have a six-month grace period to repay, which ends on March 31, 2021. However, unpaid rent accrued during the time period of October through December 2020 has no grace period and must be repaid on January 1, 2021. Again, that's the state moratorium, not the local one. For example, if a tenant was unable to pay rent in September and October of 2020, but scraped together enough to cover the other months of the year, on January 1st, they would be on the hook for October and January's rent, including being subject to eviction for non-payment, while still having until June 30th to pay off September's rent. With the new state rules, however, tenants must sign and give their landlord a legal document declaring that they have been unable to pay some or all rent after March 16, 2020 due to COVID-related reasons. If they give their landlord this document, they will have until July 1st to pay back October through December rent. If they do not provide the document, they will still need to pay that rent by January 1st or face eviction. Landlords with tenants who provide this document can now also apply to the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department to have 80% of back rent covered by the state. Landlords who access this program will be required to forgive the remaining 20% of back rent. The state allocated $150 million for this program, and landlords who qualify will be prioritized based on the number of tenants they have and how much back rent they are owed. So, to circle back to Multnomah County and Portland residents, while the local eviction moratorium is stronger than that offered by the state, the Landlord Compensation Fund still applies to local landlords. That means that local renters may still want to provide their landlords with the declaration of inability to pay rent due to COVID, since they could potentially have their back rent paid for and forgiven through the state program. It probably goes without saying that local landlords might also put the pressure on tenants to provide that documentation so that they can access the state fund. The new state policy also extends the typical 72-hour eviction notice requirement to 10 days and requires landlords to provide a copy of the inability to pay form along with any eviction notice. If the tenant facing eviction did indeed have a COVID-related reason for not paying rent and can return the form to their landlord in a timely manner, the landlord cannot proceed with the eviction filing at that time. This is all very complicated and leaves a lot of room for misinterpretation. Tenants who are unsure of their rights or who feel that they are being pressured or treated unfairly by their landlords can reach out for guidance to the Community Alliance of Tenants, Legal Aid Services of Oregon, and the Fair Housing Council of Oregon, as well as local activist groups like Portland Tenants United. A transcript of this story, with relevant links, will be posted to the KBOO Evening News page. Now, as of Monday, there is also an extended federal eviction moratorium through the CDC, but it requires that tenants meet 5 criteria and sign a declaration form. Those criteria are that the tenant has tried to obtain rental assistance, makes less than $99,000 a year, and has had trouble making rent payments due to the loss of income or medical costs, has tried to at least make partial payments, and is in danger of falling into homelessness. The CDC moratorium has only been extended until January 31st, on the assumption that President-elect Joe Biden will extend it further when he takes office. The moratorium is part of a larger stimulus bill responding to the COVID-19 pandemic, which President Trump has yet to sign into law. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman.
A new survey by the Oregon Glaciers Institute found that nearly 50% of Oregon's 56 glaciers are gone. The cause is attributed to climate change. Of the 56 glaciers, 36 were officially named in a U.S. Geological Survey when topographic maps were made first in the 1950s. Anders Carlson and Aaron Hartz founded the Oregon Glaciers Institute in May of 2020 to document and study the causes of glacier change in Oregon. Over the summer, they took aerial and close-up photos of Oregon's glaciers to build a database of presence and lack of ice. They found that glaciers have decreased in size or completely disappeared due to a consistent trend of warming annual temperatures and drier winters since the 1950s. In a December webcast documenting their findings, Aaron Hartz highlighted why glaciers are important and why Oregonians should be concerned that they're disappearing. A primary concern is that glaciers are a source of drinking water. Hartz said, quote, Glaciers are a water resource. Glaciers are water locked up in frozen form. In the mountains, after the seasonal snowpack has melted away, it's the glaciers that are feeding mountain streams. He went on to explain that glaciers feed into watersheds that supply Bend, Eugene, Corvallis, Salem, Portland, and all the cities in the Willamette Valley with clean water for drinking and agricultural use. Hartz also called to attention the importance of glaciers in supporting healthy habitats by supplying cold water for fish, animal, and forests. Looking ahead, it's expected glaciers will continue to shrink and disappear as the climate warms over time. The Oregon Glaciers Institute will continue to monitor Oregon's glaciers annually to document changes and encourage people to take action on climate change. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the Portland Youth Philharmonic's concert at Christmas, which is now in its 59th year. After that, we'll bring you news from the Boo, your look at the news inside KBOO. At 6, it's the Underground, then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear with a low of 30 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be partly cloudy with a high of 47. Today in history, on this day in 1958, musician Victoria Williams was born. Diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in the early 90s, she was the catalyst for the Sweet Relief Musicians Fund, a nonprofit that musicians can draw from when in need of medical care or financial help. The quote of the day is from Zoe Samudzi, known for her recent book on radical black anti-fascism called As Black as Resistance. She writes, quote, "We are not ready to fight because we love fighting. We are ready to fight because we are worth fighting for." President Trump has threatened to send the just-passed COVID-19 relief bill back to Congress, claiming the bill delivers too much money to foreign countries and not enough to Americans. Trump's Secretary of Treasury, Steve Mnuchin, praised the package on Tuesday. Trump's objections were surprising to both sides of the aisle. He has said he wants the pandemic relief checks to be $2,000, not $600. Trump said of the stimulus package, quote, "It is called the COVID relief bill, but it has almost nothing to do with COVID." Progressives in Congress had originally pushed to get checks of $1,200, but mainstream Democrats, including House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and President-elect Joe Biden, bargained down to the $600 amount. Most Republicans were against any payment to individuals being included in the bill at all. But for once, House Speaker Pelosi says she agrees with Trump and plans to bring the $2,000 payments to a floor vote soon. The pandemic relief package seems to have enough congressional support to override a presidential veto, should that happen. The leader of Canada's largest Indigenous organization says the government must invest in Indigenous communities in the wake of the pandemic. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The leader of Canada's largest Indigenous organization says the government must build back better for Indigenous people in the wake of the pandemic. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, Perry Bellegard says Ottawa must invest in closing the gap for Indigenous people.
As he prepares to exit his leadership of the Assembly of First Nations, National Chief Perry Bellegard recently spoke to the virtual General Assembly of the organization he's led for 6 years. He said there's a deep rift carved by decades and centuries of racism, discrimination, and indifference. And that gap has been amplified by the coronavirus pandemic, from the risk of infection to the stress of lockdown. Bellegard said a lot has been done on testing, on treatment, resources, COVID-19 response, and personal protective equipment. But the work isn't finished.
When Canada starts rolling out a vaccine, we must ensure that First Nations people, regardless of where we live, that we're not left out again. And so now we must all join together to make sure that we're all protected. No one is safe until we're all safe.
Bellegarde said over the coming months he will continue to advocate for the needs of First Nations communities for the help they will need to get through the health crisis. He said it's also an opportunity to build back better as the country rebuilds the economy. He said there can be no reconciliation without a big change to keep Indigenous people safe and guaranteed of a better future. The AFN wants the government in Ottawa to do more to deal with the disproportionate impact the pandemic is having on Indigenous communities. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The COVID relief and federal spending bill passed by Congress Monday included one of the nation's largest tribal water settlements in history. Aaron Bolton reports the settlement will provide the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes of Northwest Montana with nearly $2 billion for a local irrigation project.
The Montana Water Rights Protection Act passed on the coattails of the larger COVID relief and federal omnibus spending bill late Monday evening. The bill ratifies what's known as the CSKT Water Compact. During a virtual press conference Tuesday, CSKT Chairwoman Shelley Fiant told reporters the passage of the compact was decades in the making.
We chose the path of negotiation, and now we can avoid decades of acrimonious litigation on streams across much of Montana and protect many streams with sufficient amounts of water to ensure that fish can survive.
Under the compact, the tribes will relinquish thousands of water rights claims on and off the reservation in exchange for nearly $2 billion to revitalize the Flathead Irrigation Project and management of the National Bison Range. Fiant says the range will remain open to the public and will be professionally managed.
And who better to do it than the original inhabitants of the land who depended on the buffalo for centuries? That was our mainstay.
Reacquiring ownership of the National Bison Range has been a long-standing priority for the tribes and was rolled into the most recent version of federal legislation introduced by Republican Senator Steve Daines. His counterpart, Democratic Senator John Tester, first introduced a bill to ratify the compact in 2016, a year after Montana lawmakers approved the settlement. For National Native News, I'm Aaron Bolton.
Pfizer's chief executive will join Navajo health officials and tribal leaders Thursday during a virtual town hall to discuss the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine. The update comes as the Navajo Nation and tribes across the country have started vaccinations in their communities. The Navajo Nation received doses of the Pfizer vaccine last week. Among the first to get the shots were healthcare workers. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael says, be careful what you give.
Black ice warning last night. Winter is here. Frost on the tents all over town. We were reminded again how Congress spells relief, echoing Billie Holiday, them that's got shall get, them that's not shall lose. Santa Joe compromised on $600 for each of us before he even tried to fight for more, and Donnie's now trying to scuttle the whole deal with cynical generosity. The state senator from Roseburg tore off his mask in the Senate in protest. Roseburg, where one ill person went to work, causing 7 deaths and over 300 quarantines. Meanwhile, a couple landlords have sued the state, wanting more money for themselves to offset the eviction moratorium. It's the season of giving. Giving a virus, giving the finger to those trying to protect everyone, giving up to isolation and depression. Give yourself a break. If you can't be with the ones you love, love the one you are. Probably the new year won't begin on January 1st or the 19th, but it will get here. So be among those already working to make 2021 compassionate and wonderful. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
A new COVID-19 mutation is quickly spreading in South Africa, and scientists say it could be more contagious than the COVID-19 we're used to. Scientists believe it may also hit young people harder and could be slightly more resistant to vaccines. There is no clear evidence yet of the new variant making the disease more severe or causing worse outcomes. That said, epidemiologists point out that the death rates could increase if the new variant spreads fast and overwhelms healthcare systems. There are also fears that the many individual mutations in the COVID variant could mean it is able to reinfect people who have already caught the virus and recovered. The variant was originally isolated to coastal regions of South Africa, but has now spread rapidly throughout the country. South Africa has recorded almost 1 million cases of COVID-19, with nearly 25,000 official deaths. With vaccine distribution ramping up, disability advocates say it's important to know if you are at increased risk of getting the virus, Andrea Sears with the Public News Service has more on the story.
With coronavirus vaccines now being distributed, advocates for people living with disabilities are stressing the importance of knowing if they are at increased risk of COVID-19. People with certain disabilities or on medications with particular side effects are more vulnerable to the effects of the virus, and people in nursing homes or group housing are more likely to become infected. These and other considerations will determine the priorities for vaccine distribution. Susan Dua with the Center for Independence of the Disabled New York says the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has information online about who is at greatest risk.
There's a whole list of chronic or serious health conditions that would put them in the higher risk category, that puts them higher up to receive vaccination.
Information about COVID-19 vaccines and conditions that put people at increased risk from the coronavirus can be found on the CDC website at cdc.gov. Dua cautions that some people with specific health conditions may be advised not to get the vaccinations currently available, so it's important to find out if they could be at risk of an adverse reaction.
People should speak with their own health practitioner and ask, based on their own health status and the medications they're taking, whether the vaccine is right for them at present.
Conditions that warrant consulting a healthcare provider include allergic reactions to any of the ingredients of the COVID vaccine or to other vaccines. Dua points out that people living in nursing homes or other care facilities in New York can get help if their facilities fail to provide adequate information or explanations of vaccine risks and protocols.
You can call the New York Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program if you believe perhaps that your right to be educated and to consent freely is being violated.
Listings of long-term care ombudsmen by county are available through the New York Office for the Aging website at aging.ny.gov. For Public News Service, I'm Andrea Sears.
President Trump announced some early Christmas gifts yesterday, 15 pardons and 5 sentence commutations. Pardon recipients included 4 Blackwater contractors convicted of a massacre in Iraq, a former campaign aide caught up in the Russia investigation, and 3 disgraced former Republican congressmen. All 3 congressmen had been convicted of misuse of funds or fraud. Trump also pardoned 2 former Border Patrol agents who were found guilty of crimes related to shooting an unarmed man who was smuggling marijuana in 2005. More pardons are expected, including possible preemptive pardons for Trump himself and members of his family who worked in his administration. An earlier analysis by the Lawfare blog found that many of Trump's clemency recipients have had a, quote, personal or political connection to the president. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, December 23rd, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Hendrik Brokoschin, Sam Bowman, Samantha Law, and Dan Raphael. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Andrea Sears, and Eric Tegadoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth. We're hearing about the Portland Youth Philharmonic's concert at Christmas. Thank you.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
We've had several in-depth conversations recently with Portland-based artists and arts organizations that have gone online during the COVID-19 pandemic. The list includes the annual Portland Book Festival last month, organized by Amanda Bullock and the folks at Literary Arts, and Tom Bray's long-running A Christmas Carol, a Victorian reading which live-streamed last week. And I'm always amazed by the passion, persistence, creativity, and adaptability required to follow the old saying, the show must go on. Fortunately for us, the Portland Youth Philharmonic is taking the same path. Now in their 97th season, PYP will be live streaming their 59th annual concert at Christmas this Saturday, December 26th at 7 p.m. And I think it's safe to say, out of all those 59 performances, this is the first one that's going virtual. To find out more about Saturday's concert and how the musicians have been coping during the pandemic, we're joined by one of our favorite guests, David Hattner, the musical director of Portland Youth Philharmonic. David, thanks for joining us today.
It's good to be here, Ken, as always.
That's how I want to start off. I want to say how nice it is to talk with you again. I think you were the last guest, actually, I interviewed live in the KBOO studios. I remember even then there was talk of COVID and we elbow bumped, I think, instead of shook hands, if people can remember that far back. And the studios, of course, have been shut down since mid-March because of the quarantine. How have you and the musicians adapted to carrying on this incredible PYP tradition as the oldest continuously operating youth orchestra in the country, now going on 97 years? That's a streak I don't think you'd want to break.
Well, we don't. We played our concert on March 7th, which you may remember was a particularly interesting program, which included the Brahms Fourth Symphony and the Korngold Violin Concerto. And we made the decision to stop rehearsing after that and wait to see what would happen. And as it turned out, nothing happened after that. That's, as far as I know, the first canceled performance in the 96, 95 and a half years at the time history of the organization was that May concert, which we were really looking forward to because last year's orchestra was even among a exceptional series of fine orchestras the orchestra's put on stage. It was a very, very good one. And we decided not to try to fill in the blanks with a virtual performance at that time. Some early attempts at that were already being done in the spring to make compilation videos of performers into a quasi orchestra. And just the amount of work and trying to figure out how to rehearse it, we were not prepared for that. So we went into the brainstorm area. It was evident to me fairly quickly that there wouldn't be an in-person fall season. So we thought, at least until January, let's make a plan. And discussions ensued. And my feeling was that if we're going to have an orchestra of musicians in little boxes on the screen, let's break out and commission music that's written to be performed that way, from original conception of new composers, music for this situation. And that was what we performed on our opening concert, which was in November. All new compositions, I believe 14 of them, created just for the Portland Youth Philharmonic and any other youth orchestras that wanted to use them. And now our concert at Christmas, which, as you know, features all of the musicians of the organization, not just the Philharmonic Orchestra, but Conservatory Orchestra, Wind Ensemble, and Young String Ensemble, and Percussion Ensemble. We're not playing contemporary music, but we're playing mostly fresh arrangements of music that I think the audience will recognize and enjoy. Some of it is classical, little pieces from the Nutcracker, and some of it is from the popular music world, pieces suggested by the musicians of our orchestra, and some of it is from the movies. So it's be a fun, short concert that will feature our musicians in various groupings and should be really enjoyable.
Yeah, we should mention some of those. I looked at the program, of course, and you're doing a holiday classic. You're A Mean One, Mr. Grinch, I mean, from the world of popular music. A Korean group I've never heard of, but I'm kind of out of it when it comes to popular culture, BTS. They have a song called Dynamite you'll be doing. the brass ensemble will be doing the theme from the Marvel movie, The Avengers, and there's even a Beatles tune to close things out. How did you select those pieces along with the chestnuts like Tchaikovsky and Vivaldi?
We surveyed our musicians. It's something we tended not to do as an educational organization. In many ways, it's our job to pick the curriculum as the faculty, if you will. And this year, we thought it's been such a difficult year for young people. They're missing out on so much. But they do share a lot of things in common. And among those is an interest in the popular music of today. And so BTS is everywhere. People are crazy about it. And that was sort of the number one vote getter was Dynamite. So I called my good friend and colleague Ken Seldon, the conductor of the Portland State University Orchestra, and he made a fresh arrangement of it for strings and electric bass. And we learned it and recorded it. And those movie themes like The Avengers and Do You Want to Build a Snowman, those came up as well. Most of the pieces on the program were voted on by the students. So that's really where all that came from. And Lennon McCartney, that came from me. You may know that I'm passionate about the music of the Beatles. All of them as composers, I think, are superior. And I thought that this particular song, which was written for the first ever international satellite television broadcast, would be a particularly appropriate selection for our broadcast of this concert. And it gave a chance to have a couple of our alumni, Kate and Emma Davis, who have sung in orchestra concerts when they were members of the orchestra years ago, to perform with us. Kate, of course, is a highly regarded singer-songwriter and bass player in New York City, and so she was happy to participate.
Will she be in New York for the performance?
Yeah, she recorded it in New York, and her sister Emma recorded it from another state. And Kate also contributed the electric bass line to the song Dynamite, which is in many ways the most interesting line in that piece, because the melody is, it's almost so simple it's not really a melody. It's really BTS's performance that makes that song what it is, and the bass line, which is a heavily Motown inspired syncopated funky bass line, which of course as a top professional, she put that down with no problem at all.
So you mentioned earlier about the musicians performing in little boxes. Certainly quite a few challenges associated with live streaming during the pandemic. But there were also, I guess, some advantages by getting some of the alumni like Kate and Emma Davis, who are not in Portland and probably would not be at the Schnitzer if there was a live performance of the Christmas concert. So kind of taking some of the good with the bad.
Yes. Normally, we have an entire orchestra of alumni that performs every December 26th, and we decided to not do that. We invited alumni who wished to participate to record the clapping track for the BTS Dynamite, because it added a little something to have some clapping during some parts of the song. So some of our alumni recorded themselves clapping to the click track at certain parts. Ken even wrote two different clapping parts for people to choose from. So it's interesting, as a conductor, a lot of the job is balancing the different voices in the composition. And that's all done by a computer technician now, deciding what to bring up and what to emphasize, since all the parts are recorded one at a time and then are loaded into a computer and aligned. And then you can decide what comes up and what comes down. So we've discovered that of all the professions in the world, conducting may be the most useless in a pandemic. It really serves no function anymore.
Because you need a live orchestra there rather than people and their musicians in their little boxes.
Yeah, and contribute nothing to the sound directly.
So performances have all been recorded and then mastered and edited together into the show. So it's not like any of the musicians going to be sitting in their homes on Saturday night performing live.
Nope, all of us will be audience. And for the musicians, I can't experience what they're experiencing because their performance was weeks ago. They played their part with a metronome and a little electronic version of the piece in their ear to guide them. and then they send it in, and it goes to the editor, and they don't hear it again until they get to see the final edited version on screen, which I think will be exciting for them to see, like, their rather plain contribution woven together into this virtual orchestra. So I'm excited for them, and their families, I hope, will enjoy it very much.
In the finished product, do you notice any difference in the performances and kind of the whole feel of the performance as opposed to, you know, being on stage at the Schnitzer Concert Hall and performing live?
Well, it couldn't be more different. It's more like a film now, like a movie, where, you know, a movie is completely an illusion, because when it's made, there's no continuity. They might shoot the last scene of the film first,
right,
and then something from the middle, and depending on who's on set. So it's a little like that. Once it's edited, it's set in stone. It's always the same. It never changes. It will always permanently, unless the editor decides to make a new director's cut or something
right,
like that. What's missing is any sense of spontaneity in the music making, which is the most important part of live music making, really, in any genre, is the feeling that, yes, we just rehearsed this on stage an hour ago before the concert, but now there's a new energy in the room. There are people listening, and they somehow telepathically require us to add some expression here or take a little more time here. None of that is, of course, possible. There are tempo maintenance has to be 100% strict and unchanging, which informs our choice of material. Something that has a lot of changing of the tempo is just not doable. So we had to pick pieces that were somewhat march-like in character, or, you know, had a beat to them, rather than things that are more melodic or soulful. So that's one of the most important differences. You have to accept the medium for what it is. That's why I wanted new music for the rest of our season. Once we get started again in January, we'll have another few dozen compositions that we'll be learning for the rest of our season. And that, again, conceived with the knowledge that you can't have gradual tempo changes or radical tempo changes, that it all has to be mathematically relative if you're going to change something. And also how things are aligned can be thought of in new ways by composers. So all that's going to be very interesting. But in the meantime, yeah, this concert, it's done. It's not going to ever change. It'll always be the same every time you listen to it.
So it seems you and PYP have adapted so well, but I get the feeling you can't wait until you're in front waving that baton in front of the live complete orchestra on stage all together.
It's going to be an emotional experience for all of us to go back when it's time. It's just very special what happens with any orchestra. It'll be that way for every orchestra of the world. You know, some of them have been playing concerts for over 100 years, including the Oregon Symphony. And when they get back together and, you know, hear each other's sound melding together for the first time, it's going to be overwhelming for a lot of people. And as everyone knows, because either we are young or we used to be young, all the emotional aspects of being human are amplified in the adolescent years. They feel it more strongly. And having been deprived temporarily, hopefully temporarily, of the opportunity to do what PYP does, which is a very special thing, they'll never take it for granted again, nor will I. And that's going to make those first notes really memorable.
Well, David, again, many thanks for joining us today, and happy holidays to
thanks,
you,
Ken,
the musicians, and everyone at PYP.
Absolutely. You know, happy New Year to everybody out there, and come join us on Saturday. It'll be a fun hour.
We've been talking with David Hattner, musical director of the Portland Youth Philharmonic. David and PYP will be live streaming their 59th annual concert at Christmas this Saturday, December 26th at 7 p.m. You can find out more online and purchase tickets at Portland Youth Phil, that's Phil as in PHIL.org. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News In Depth.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO with news from your community radio station.
Well, good evening. You are listening to News from the Boo here on KBOO Community Radio. I am your host, Jenna Yokoyama, and I'm also one of your interim station co-managers. Here on News from the Boo, we talk about all things KBOO, inside, outside. KBOO, it's for our volunteers. It's for our members. It's for our listeners, anyone who's interested in learning about KBOO. And today, like, if you're a normal listener and you say, you sound different, well, that's because today I am coming from my echo chamber. I'm just kind of weirded out by the echo. And I have... And that was my very special guest for today, Celeste Carey. Celeste, welcome to the very last News for the Boo for 2020.
Hey, we made it. We made it.
I know. Can you imagine that?
No, I can't. I mean, when we saw...